Warning, this episode contains spoilers and strong language.
They said we're gonna put a play together, though we don't know yet what it's about. We'll let everybody be in it, so that there's no one left to be in the crowd. No, you think I'm wasting time here, not sculpting up an image to play. This is my last letter, and here's the last thing I'll say.
Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode of ShumaCast. I'm Noel, being joined, as always, by Angie.
Hey, everybody.
And I have to apologize to everyone for my voice. Obviously, I am ill.
It's not that bad.
We will power through. I've recorded with worse. Very special guest today. Everybody, please welcome Wendy.
Hi there.
Welcome.
My name's Wendy Bowlesby. I met Noel because he's a good friend of Melissa Kircher, friend of the show. And Melissa and I had a podcast for several years called Xanadu Cinema Pleasure Dome. If you want to seek it out in the wilds of the historic internet, you can listen to two women get drunk and talk about movies. It's, I'm sure, quite entertaining. These days, I podcast with a couple of my friends. We do A Real Education, the musical, where we bring in at least one person who has not seen the movie before. We watch the movie together and we talk about it, and we focus specifically on musicals because I love them. And you can find that at Real Edu Musical. And we're on Facebook, Twitter. There's a website. We're on iTunes and Blueberry. Other than that, I spend my time doing film festivals and playing roller derby.
Which is a fun life to live.
Yeah, it gets me by.
This being a Joel Schumacher podcast series, what is your history with and overall opinion of the work of Joel Schumacher?
Oh, it's complicated.
Once you get past Batman.
See, that's the thing is Batman and Robin tainted things. It like went back through time and said, this is all shit now. Oh, can I cuss?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, good. Because otherwise it's going to be a very difficult podcast for me. But I was born in 1970. So like Lost Boys in 85, 86. I was 15. I was the perfect age. I loved that movie. St. Elmo's Fire is a little young for that breakthrough. I was like, this is a whole lot of adults being emotional. But between Lost Boys and then Flatliners, I thought this guy was great. I liked his vibe a lot. And then he just sort of disappeared. And then the one we're going to talk about today, Falling Down, came out. And I'm like, okay, this is interesting. Okay. And then Batman Forever came along. I was like, well, okay. And then Time to Kill, I'm like, okay, we're back on the dramatic vibe. Sure, sure. And then Batman and Robin just forever was like, oh, God, you made one of the biggest film turds in history. How does anybody take you seriously? Then he did 8mm. He went back to small, flawless. Like, these were not bad films. And Phone Booth 2. But Phantom of the Opera just, for me, put a nail in the coffin of, that's a 1-2 punch between Batman and Robin and Phantom of the Opera of, like, what are you doing? Nobody should let you have a budget. Like, not a big budget. Keep it small and you keep things under control, buddy. But that said, he's got flair. That's a good way to put it. Like, knowing that he was a fashion designer and a costumer first, you can tell he's so visual in the way he approaches things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's not a bad director. I think the problem is that when he gets too much money and he's given too much free rein, he doesn't know how to control his own worst impulses. And those are my thoughts on Mr. Schumacher.
Okay. And people will be able to hear expanded thoughts on Phantom of the Opera because we still have you planned on for that one.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I've never seen it.
Oh, my God.
I've never seen a single version of Phantom of the Opera, but we'll get there when we get there.
Yeah.
Be prepared. That one might be a mega episode. I have so much to say.
So moving on to the subject of today's episode, Falling Down, the 1993 film directed by Joel Schumacher. Falling Down was written by Ebby Rowe Smith, a character actor who was a semi-regular on Murphy Brown. He pops up on Portlandia. He's kind of this small background character actor in a lot of things. In this movie, he plays the guy who helps push the car off the road in the beginning of the movie, the ceramic salesman.
Oh, okay. Sure, yeah.
This was his first original screenplay. He also wrote the 1990s film reboot of Car 54, Where Are You?
Okay. That's a piece of trivia.
That's his only other credited script, but he also did uncredited work on the thrillers Mad City, Nick of Time, and U.S. Marshals. And that's about it for his writing career. He's actually started self-publishing some novellas through Amazon, but he's kept going as an actor. This was one of those notorious scripts that passed around Hollywood for a couple of years where everyone wanted to read it, but nobody wanted to make it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And it was almost done by Paul Verhoeven.
Oh, that would be a very different film.
It was almost done as a cheap HBO TV movie. And then when Joel got a hold of it, he fell in love with it, and he brought in Michael Douglas, who had produced Flatliners.
Yeah, the two of them had a history together.
He wanted Michael Douglas involved, and that led to it getting made, and we'll get into the release. That's pretty much all I have for the initial production notes. I can hear my voice going.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
So we'll have a little edit bleep, and I will record the synopsis when my throat is at a better point in time.
We open on a man, buzz cut, white dress shirt and tie, completely unassuming and lacking any form of identity aside from a personalized license plate reading D-Fens. This man is very rapidly melting down as he's stuck in gridlock traffic during a Los Angeles heat wave, and it's not long before he abandons his car, telling dumbstruck drivers he's going home. He stops at a Korean supermarket, and in his first act of violence, steals the teller's baseball bat and starts smashing product off the shelves in outrage at the inflated prices. After then paying for a soda and walking away, he's then accosted in a park by Latin gang members who want him to pay a toll for crossing their property. When he bashes them away with the bat, they return to retaliate with a drive-by shooting, but when they miss him and crash into oncoming traffic, the man makes off with their bag full of guns. Stopping in a Wham Burger for breakfast, he breaks out the guns when he learns he'll have to order from the lunch menu. After shooting up a phone booth and taking in other miserable souls in the city along his odyssey, the man stops in a military surplus store to replace his worn shoes with hiking boots, and finds out the owner is a neo-Nazi who's in awe at the crimes coming in over the police band, and sees the man as a hero and wants to further his rampage by offering him a bazooka. The man is disgusted with this neo-Nazi trying to compare him to the Shrines of Hate, and after a conflict, the man has his first kill as he shoots the neo-Nazi down, redresses himself in a simple military jumpsuit, and uses the bazooka on a seemingly pointless construction project that's creating the exact same gridlock we opened the movie on. During all of this, we also intercut with Martin Pendergrast, a robbery cop on his last day before retirement, who helped clear the abandoned vehicle after being caught in the same opening traffic jam. He's in the midst of his own crisis, having won the scorn of his peers after moving to a desk job, even though both it and his retirement are to appease his wife who's become emotionally volatile after the death of their young daughter. Instead of erupting in anger, he approaches his constant stream of frustrations with charm and whimsy, and a friendly manner that wins people over. Though dismissed by everyone but his former partner, he's the only one putting together the pieces that the string of crimes being committed this day are all by the same man. Digging further, he learns the man is Bill Foster, a divorced and recently laid-off defense contractor who's been living with his mother, who's protective of him while also being terrified of his silent judgment and repressed anger. It turns out Bill's entire journey this day has been to return to his ex-wife's home to celebrate his daughter's birthday party, which doesn't go over well with his ex-wife Beth, who keeps trying to contact the cops to enforce the restraining order she has over Bill's anger and emotional abuse. After violently cutting his way through a golf course and taking shelter with a terrified family around a pool, Bill makes his way home, leading to the finale where Prendergast catches up to Bill as the man confronts his wife on a pier. Prendergast gets the upper hand, holding a gun on Bill while Beth and their daughter make a break for it, but his attempts to talk Bill down are for naught as Bill makes for his own gun. Prendergast gets off a shot, only then realizing Bill's weapon was his daughter's squirt gun. Bill falls into the waters below, and Prendergast decides he's not ready to give up being a cop.
Have any of you seen this film before?
Yes, I saw it when it came out.
I had not. It's a film that I have heard about for years and had been meaning to want to get to. And then, of course, once we did this podcast, I was like, okay, I'm going to save it.
And yeah, that's another one for me. It's I've heard about it for a long time. I've always been curious about it, but this is my first time seeing it.
I was just becoming a cinephile. I was a baby cinephile when I saw the trailer for this. And I remember me and my friends thinking, that looks interesting. The trailer looked so fascinating. It looked like the sort of movie of The Ordinary Man. And he finally sticks it to all the things that just drive us fucking crazy. Yeah. So I actually was excited for it to come out. I didn't just happen across it. I was actually anticipating it and went to see it in the theaters. And I remember thinking it was one of those films where the first half of the movie gave you what you thought you were going to get. And then the second half was very, very different. And I remember at the time thinking it felt disjointed. Watching it now, it's not. But it may have been a function of the way marketing can honestly sometimes just fuck up your movie experience.
Mm. Well, in general, do you recommend this movie?
Yes. Having now rewatched it, I don't know if I would have. I had a memory of it being, an interesting performance by Michael Douglas. Nah. Rewatching it, yeah, I would definitely recommend it.
Angie, do you recommend it?
I would as well. Maybe not quite as enthusiastically. I have certain things I have reservations about. One thing I really don't like. But overall, I think it's a very interesting film. It's worth watching. It's worth talking about. No matter who you are, I think you should at least watch the opening scene because I think we can all thoroughly relate to that feeling. And it's so wonderfully shot.
And Whamburger.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a recommend. It's a recommend.
Yeah, I recommend it too. It's a little uneven at parts. There's a couple of bits that don't quite work for me, but the majority of it is a really striking, intelligently provocative movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It pushes a lot of buttons, but not in a very juvenile way. It's genuinely exploring emotions and consequence. And it's not a very easy movie. I can see why it flared a lot of tempers when it came out.
Sure.
But I think it is very smart about how it plays those notes and how it builds that story of this emotional collapse. It really juggles being a wish fulfillment fantasy and a, oh yeah, you should never do this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's why it feels a little disjointed. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you're totally on board with what he's doing. Like, yes, I hate that about our culture.
Yeah.
Yes, I do want you to smash him up for charging a ridiculous amount for a soda. But on the other hand.
Yeah.
So Angie, what did you think about the main character? He's first unknown, and then in the script described him just as defense for most of the entire movie before we learned his name.
Man, he's complex. One of my sort of reservations about it is Fight Club is one of my absolute favorite movies of all time. And then I found out that there are people who take Tyler Durden literally and want to be him. And I'm like, whoa, back up. In a very similar way, I feel like people could watch this and feel the same way about this character.
They have.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
And like the people who watch Rick and Morty and think that Rick is an outstanding misunderstood guy. Like, no people. Yeah. No. It's a very interesting line. It just worries me about the people who won't get it. But I do think he's a great mix between there's elements of sympathetic nature to him, but then also he takes it so far that you then become repulsed and you're just like, whoa, somebody stop this guy now. It's a fascinating character study for sure.
Well, yeah. I remember this movie as this celebration, this vindication of the anger of the common man. We are right to be angry. And yet the very first scene where he walks into the convenience store and he smashes it up because the prices are so damn high, he's a racist asshole.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It's a smart script. Right off the bat, the film is like, you want to cheer for this guy, but should you? And so it's an uncomfortable watch, and I think that's why it had such a weird reception when it came out. And to your point, Angie, it is the problem of people want to celebrate this character, and it's like, No, you should not celebrate this character. It's a tragic character because he's so broken inside. Okay, I cannot watch this film from our perspective right now. And what I see is a movie that is 20 years old that was already grappling with the perils of toxic masculinity.
Yes.
Sure.
20 years ago, they were trying to bring up that our culture and what it does to men breaks them.
Yeah.
And it gives them nowhere to go. They have no resources when bad things happen. They don't know how to handle it. They don't know how to have any emotional intelligence to deal with it. So I see this movie now and I'm like, oh, more people need to watch this right now so we can talk about that 20 years ago we were starting to see it. We just decided to maybe ignore it for another couple of decades.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing that is still relevant to today. And in fact, this film, unfortunately, has resurfaced as something that the alt-right movement has attached themselves to.
Because they fucking missed the point.
Exactly. Right. And even there have been several mass shooters who were huge fans of the movie. And again, it's like they're missing the point in the same way the lead character is missing the point.
Yeah.
But that said, because it is still a 90s film, it doesn't quite stick the landing because what's our hero moment with Robert Duvall with Prendergast is when he tells off his wife in a really sexist way.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're doing so good deconstructing this one character and pointing out that you want to cheer for him, but maybe you shouldn't. And then it's a straight up hero moment with Robert Duvall. So when we get there, put a pin in that.
Yeah.
A lot of reviews accuse this film of trying to have its cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think what's fascinating is that the film actually explores the mentality of someone who's trying to have his cake and eat it too. And again, toxic masculinity, entitlement, generational gaps.
Yeah.
Make America great again or bring it back to how it used to be.
Yeah.
He does. He wants it to be the way it used to be. But it drives me crazy. It's like the way it used to be is we didn't have the internet. I love that I can look up anything and find the answer as opposed to just hoping that somebody I know might know the answer. Can we remember the days where, honest to God, you might just start calling your friends on the phone like, okay, so I'm trying to remember that one movie and it had the guy. Can you figure out what I'm talking about? I don't want to go back to when America was great. I would like to make America great, period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's very much a character who lacks the ability to reflect on the fact that he might be causing his own problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
One of my favorite scenes is even after, you know, he's chased his wife out of the home and he's come back and he's watching the family movies. And it gets to the point in the family movies where he sees himself erupting in anger and yelling at his wife and child. And yet, even then, it still doesn't seem to resonate to him, even though it's like, there, that's exactly what caused this.
You think he's having a revelation, but instead he's just going, oh, I should go to the pier. That's where they are. Mm-hmm. That's what's really happening.
I disagree. I think Michael Douglas's performance there is a little bit more subtle. He sees that moment. His face reflects that he's seeing that it wasn't the perfect family. I don't know if it's capable of self-reflection of that one's on me.
Yeah.
But he's seeing that this was a moment where they weren't happy. And why couldn't we be happy? And then he's sidetracked when he realizes that he knows where they are.
Yeah, you may be right.
And it's getting into the whole thing of, well, we're supposed to be happy. Everything is supposed to work out. I have a job. It's supposed to go well for me.
Yeah.
And in fact, I like that they made him a defense contractor because defense contractors went hugely out of business after the collapse of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I got to thinking, what else was going on along culturally at this time? I mean, it was the LA riots.
This literally filmed during the LA riots.
And obviously AIDS and the homeless. There was a big homeless explosion at that time. We'd just gotten done with the first Iraq War. We were wrapping it up. Oh, and side note, my podcast, A Real Education, the musical, we just did an episode on Rent where we were criticizing Chris Columbus, the director of that movie, that he's in Alphabet City, Manhattan, and everything looks so clean and sanitized. And I watched Falling Down and I'm like, Joel Schumacher would have done a better job with Rent. This is grimy and gritty as fuck.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just looks filthy and ugly and dusty and faded and everything is so degenerate. I really like the look. I like the landscape he traverses as all of the metaphors that it so clearly is.
So many directors would overdo it with conveying the heat by like tinting everything bright orange or red. And I like that he just has this soft salmon color.
Yeah.
Where it conveys the heat without being overwhelming. It just makes the heat its own subtle frustration. It's lingering. It's not overwhelming everything, but it's just always there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I kept noticing the smog and the dust haze.
Yeah.
Sure.
Los Angeles does not look like an attractive place to live in this movie.
Right.
No, it does not.
But I like that you even have that contrast between the streets, the park full of homeless people, plus then the golf course and then the poolside home and the rich people living up above all this other stuff.
Yeah.
Again, the people who have everything that he never was able to get, even though he had his wife and his kid and his job.
Mm-hmm.
I like that they never answer, where has he been going? He lost his job a month ago.
Right.
Where is he even going?
Has he just been driving around all day?
That like bumps you back to the beginning of this man is sitting in gridlock traffic for no reason.
Right.
Yeah.
So that moment when he cracks, it adds retroactive weight to it of realizing he's in this awful position by choice.
Mm-hmm.
He's late at getting nowhere.
Yeah. Oh, Noel, you're a poet.
I mean, even just him flailing around with the fly.
Yeah.
that one tracking shot of just going around from car to car to the mm-hmm. bus full of children to all this stuff, the Garfield on the window, all this yeah. stuff just circling around in this oppressive, all clustered together shot.
So tense.
Yeah.
Those are the moments that again remind me of how strong of a director Joel Schumacher really can be.
And then what's again fascinating about his character is it's not taking a gray approach to the ethics. It's very much, here's the good parts and the bad parts of this story alongside each other. Here's the wish fulfillment fantasy. Here's the genuine problems that come when you try to have that wish fulfillment fantasy. And then he very ever rarely gets genuine satisfaction from letting this anger out.
No.
Yeah.
It's not like he's actually ever achieving anything. That almost compounds the frustrations for him even more.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's wanting success and he did it the right way and he couldn't get it. Now he's doing it the wrong way and he can't get it. Mm-hmm. Like, how am I supposed to get it? Is it just something that I'm not allowed to get?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody loves the whammy burger scene, which it is fun. I actually like the scene on the hill with the two gang members
mm-hmm.
because I really like how that scene plays out. It's one of the few scenes where you are totally on his side. Because he's respectful to them. He says, you're right. I'm in your territory. I will go. I apologize that I was here. He treats them like equals and with a lot of respect. And then when they won't let him go, he's like, I'm trying to treat you with respect. And this is what I get. And I just can't handle it. Give us your briefcase. No, I'm not going to give you my briefcase. And then, you know, he trashes them with a baseball bat. But then he yells after him, you forgot the briefcase.
Yeah.
I just love that moment. Like, you forgot the briefcase. Come get it. And then I'm going home. Clear a path.
Yeah.
It's a great tragic moment for this character of he's so close, but then he ends up with guns. Like, I wonder if he hadn't ended up with guns, what different story we might have gotten.
Well, and I think the importance of that scene where it is, the supermarket is his first time actually letting loose with his violence.
Yeah.
And him in the park is almost him settling after that. That could have been his one outlet, and then he would have gone home. But then this incident happens that then that further cements him down this path and then leads to him then becoming fully armed. And then it's like, by the time of the drive-by, that is the point of no return.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If he had just been allowed to walk home, it would have been a very different story. He would have made different choices along the way. By the time he got to his wife and child, yeah, he had set himself on a path of no return.
Well, would he have even continued going to his wife and child, or would he have gone back home to mom?
I think he still would have kept going. I don't know that it would have been a peaceful ending even at that point.
No, I don't think it would have, but I think it would have been a, you need help, you're going to get some court-mandated counseling, we're going to put you on probation.
Yeah.
But by the time he arrives there, he's a straight-up murderer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On the hill, it makes more sense as it goes along. The main thing is the way it ends, where he picks up the knife. You could almost hear, level up.
Yes.
In the background. And so it was just a little bit too much of like an obvious, oh, he dropped the bat, now he's got the knife. And like I said, as it goes, you realize it's kind of the rhythm of the whole thing. But I guess since it's the first time, it was a little bit jarring.
It is an item quest movie, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Well, and his character switches on a dime, too. He's yelling, and then the second he picks it up, he's like, mm-hmm. How do they even do that? And he's so calm and mild-mannered again.
Right, right.
Like, there's a personality break that you're watching happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Angie, what did you think about the drive-by sequence?
That was, oh, man, like, all those poor people on the street. They didn't deserve any of that. On the hill, he was almost sympathetic. He was trying to do the right thing. And then here are all these people getting shot up around him, and he doesn't seem to care in any way. Like, am I supposed to feel okay with the fact that he only shot him in the leg? I don't think so. But I think that is the point where there's very little redeeming left in him.
I was caught that he doesn't react.
Yeah.
He had no way of knowing that there were going to be bullets come flying around him.
Right.
But he doesn't even flinch or turn. He's just like, oh, this is a thing. How disassociated is he at this point?
Yeah.
Because he walks by those people and looks at them like they're not real.
When they go to his mother's house, was he in Vietnam or?
No, that was his dad.
It was his dad?
He was probably in Korea.
Korea? Okay.
Oh, brought up by a war vet?
But he's the one that got the Purple Heart. I want to say it said William Forrester had a Purple Heart.
Because that wasn't a photo of him on the wall.
No, no, no. I know that the photo wasn't him, but there was like William Forrester Award Purple Heart. I guess if you freeze framed on it, you might see which war if they mentioned it. But, you know, obviously we don't know it at the time of the drive-by, but I'm assuming it's probably because he was in Vietnam or one of those wars that was very guerrilla warfare type.
Well, he's supposed to be in his 30s.
That's true.
Yeah, he's a contractor. He's not a soldier.
Yeah, he would have missed all the wars.
So you don't think that was his?
No.
So you think it was he's just a junior?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that was his father, because his father had the big shrine with the photo and everything.
Okay.
And I mean, the way that reflects on him of a shrine to his war vet father, given that he's grown up to have all this suppressed rage and this inability to communicate emotionally.
He feels like a child raised by a soldier.
Sure, sure.
And his mom is that fluttery, super accommodating.
Loves your child while being terrified of him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She knows there's something wrong with her kid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But she doesn't know what to do about it. And so let's just not speak of it.
Right.
Because that's what a whole generation did.
Yeah.
We just don't speak of it.
And that's also what I kind of enjoy is the sense that as we learn more about him, we learn that he has had issues with anger and rage.
Mm-hmm.
And while he's never done physical violence, he can be very verbally abusive at times.
Yeah.
This does tie back to a lot of whenever we start reading about mass shooters, it's like, yeah, he seemed like such a normal, unassuming guy, but there was always this thing about him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The misogyny, like so many of the issues in this film, I feel like they're bringing it up to criticize it, except that it also feels like a celebration sometimes. On the one hand, you get the infuriating cop of, yeah, but did he ever hit you?
Right.
Well, no, but I felt like he might. He might? Like, and what does that even say? Well, until he actually does you harm. Are you sure? Oh, it's just so frustrating to even watch that scene.
Mm-hmm.
But what I like is that the film is exploring that as he did have anger and abuse issues.
Right.
And that this is his first time escalating that to physical violence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting is the draft of the script that I read, which was mostly this film, he had hit her and he had hit the child and he had even hit his mother in the past.
Okay.
I think it's a more interesting choice not to have him.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. This is his first time taking that next step.
Right.
But it belittles her very valid fear of him. Well, yeah, but he never actually hit you. And then later, when they are trying to call the local cops to say, you need to get to this house, this man is headed there. Yeah, but it's going to be our third time out to deal with some hysterical woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm...
I like that because the film is kind of being really honest about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not painting a good picture, but I think it's doing it through intention.
Yeah. I think the biggest problem is that it's handling that so well, but it's handling Pendergrass's wife awfully at the same time.
Yeah.
You know?
There's two scenes that don't really work for me in this movie, and her storyline is one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just terrible.
Yes. The emotional trajectory of Pendergrass and how those beats work, I'm like, what are you doing here? This does not go with the other storyline.
No.
Because I think all of the stuff with the masculinity of the cops, the way the one lieutenant treats Prendergast's former partner, like the blatant sexism there, getting in the stripper for his party.
Yeah.
Like all of this sexism, all of this misogyny, I think it's intentional and I think it's meant to be a critique.
Mm-hmm.
But then Prendergast's wife.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that he literally tells her to shut up. And he's given up his career to make his wife happy. And the end of the movie, he's like, fuck my wife. I'm going to do what I want.
Mm-hmm.
Bitch, I'll be home when I'm home. My dinner better be hot. And by the way, I'm going to stay a cop.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like they're trying to play the quote unquote nagging housewife as another one of the frustrations in this movie that this film is full of.
But again, she's emotional because of a very real tragedy that happened to her.
Right.
That she, I don't think, has ever fully recovered from.
No.
And he's pandered to her. He's coddled to her.
Yeah, and he's trying to appease that emotional volatility instead of actually working through it.
Getting her some goddamn help.
Yeah.
So many times I'm like, why don't you bring your wife to a psychiatrist or therapist who can help her with the obvious PTSD she is experiencing? Not just, yes, dear, okay, dear, we'll move to Arizona, dear. Like, no, you're not helping anything, dude.
Well, and then he's like, well, she used to be beautiful and it's hard to get over that. And that's why she's got emotional problems. I'm like, everything that just came out of your mouth was pandering, mansplaining bullshit. And I need you to step back. I do love the hero moment because his captain tells him, I don't trust you because you never swear. And when he walks by and he goes, fuck you, Captain Yardley. I'm like, that's a great moment.
Yeah.
Because here's a man who has seemed a little lost and he looks more focused and back to himself by the end of the film. Great. Except that apparently becoming back to himself is throwing his wife in the trash.
Right.
Yeah. I understand what they're trying to do there, but they are not pulling it off.
No.
They're overplaying the wife too much, too, in terms of the tone.
Yeah, like, there had to have been a better way to have this cop want to retire and then change his mind at the last minute without painting such a horrible, stereotypical picture of his wife.
And then the way he shuts her down.
Yeah.
You're going to cook and my dinner better be on the table when I get home. I'm like, what?
Right.
All you needed was, and leave the skin on the chicken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's especially interesting because she was a bit of stunt casting in that Tuesday Weld was the star of the very first movie Joel Schumacher ever worked on.
Oh, yeah.
Play It As It Lays back in 1970. It didn't work. And I like
the contrast and comparison that's built between Bill and Prendergast.
Prendergast is just as overwhelmed with frustrations, but he's also someone who approaches things with a lightness and a mirth.
Yeah.
He has this disturbingly Columbo-esque way of befriending people that he's trying to get information from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, the whole wife plot, again, it's an interesting exploration of he still has that family, even though he lost his child, and that child was the most important thing he ever had, and he lost it, and Bill can't even recognize the importance of that.
Yeah.
I get the idea of having Prendergast take a stand in his own way, but I think it would have been more fitting of the character if instead of him taking a stand against the own frustrations in his life, it actually enhanced his ability to just be at peace with rolling with it.
To a degree, you can't control the people around you.
It's frustrating. It's annoying. There are ways you can try to, but at some point you just have to kind of live your life and the world is going to be what it is. And I don't say that in a defeatist way, because again, it's always keep trying, aspiring for something better, but
sure. There's only so many things in your control.
You still have to adjust and adapt and roll with the punches and all that stuff. And he's a character who can do that to a degree. That is where I think the point of contrast is, where Bill just defends. He gets defensive about everything.
Well, he's got to be in control.
Exactly.
And he doesn't feel like he has power. It comes back to everything we're dealing with culturally still, masculinity and entitlement and control.
Yeah.
And that when groups don't feel like they have power is when they take power in increasingly damaging ways. You can see, like, he just wants his daughter to sit on this stupid horse that he bought her for her birthday. And it's got to be right now. It's like, your child is overwhelmed. You've probably given her way too much sugar. She's 1 year old. What are you going to get out of shoving a crying child on a horse?
Exactly. Again, it's like, that's the way it's supposed to be. The child rides a horse and we'll be happy. And we will all be good.
And then we will have smiling videotapes forever. Yeah.
Also, I kind of love the recurring thing of that he keeps trying to get horses for his kid. And like, he even tries to get the unicorn snow globe. But what is the toy that his kid loves? A gun.
Oh, yeah. Oh. The little water gun. Yeah, that's true. I didn't think about that.
I hadn't even noticed that. That's good.
Yeah.
What I noticed was when he finally convinces in the whammy burger, like, just give me some goddamn breakfast. She turns around and just grabs it. It's sitting right there.
They hadn't gotten around to throwing them away yet, I guess.
Because it's 11:33.
Right.
And so that is a great moment because it underscores that some of our frustration with the lives we lead is justifiable.
Yeah.
How much can we thank things like Facebook and Twitter? I know that it becomes a toxic swamp when people feed on it and it becomes an echo chamber, but I get to blow off a lot of that daily frustration just by simply sending a tweet of like, this is some straight up bullshit. And then people go, you're right, it is. And I go, thank you. Now I can move on.
Social media is a reflection of the society and we're in a really fucked up, twisted, frustrating era of society in general.
Yeah, but I also think that it's a tool like anything else. You just have to use it the right way. I use it for very specific things. And when I'm frustrated, I use it as a way to rid myself of the frustration by saying it out loud, in a sense, and getting validated. All he wants is some validation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How differently would that scene have gone if the manager had said, it's stupid, I know, but this is what I am told I have to do by corporate.
I mean, if you had just taken like a handful of the people in this movie and just put them in a support group, I think they would all be better for it.
Shit, yeah. Like, why everybody needs therapy? Exhibit A.
I think one of the great mirrors to him is that scene of the guy outside the bank with the not economically viable song.
Yes.
Which was one of the scenes that Joel added.
Oh, okay.
Yes, who is dressed just like him, too.
Yeah.
And he brings it up later. I'm not economically viable. I forget who he is. He talking to...
Was that Prendergast?
It was either him or it was the family at the pool.
Oh, maybe the family. Yeah.
That's where it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really like Prendergast's relationship with his former partner. That seems healthy and sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still trying to wrap my head around, like, why that relationship?
Well, because they were partners, and then he left that behind to go behind a desk. But they still have that connection. And I also think they're kind of close because of the daughter that he lost. And so she's kind of a replacement for that connection.
Oh, yeah. The daughter he lost sort of vibe.
Sure.
But, I mean, in a screenplay, you have to look at all these comments on failures of relationships.
Yeah.
Defense and his wife. Prendergast and his wife, why this relationship? Why is this one able to work? And what are we saying that it's a work relationship, it's partnership, it's equals?
Because I think they have a connection. That they're people who, even with all the frustrations going on, that's a connection that they've forged.
Because honestly, when they go out to lunch together, that's an old married couple interaction there. What is it we get? Is it number six? No, it's seven. Two number sevens.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the old college friend that you keep meeting up with every few months after you graduate. You know, it's just they're close.
Yeah.
They just know each other. I keep wanting to go back to the Whammy Burger because that sequence is like one of those ones like the With or Without You wedding dance sequence in Cousins where scenes like this are why Joel Schumacher's career needed to happen.
Okay.
Especially because of the burger hats.
The only thing I would say is that scene becomes a comedy.
Yes.
And I just feel like we've been building so much tension, and maybe it's meant to relieve the tension.
Yes.
But it just seems a little too silly compared to everything else. And like I said, once again, I don't want to like this guy. He's a terrible guy.
Well, neither do I.
That scene doesn't actually end. They just cut away and they don't come back to it.
It's true.
Well, and they say that he actually paid for his meal and left.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But it doesn't get resolved. The last thing you see is he's complaining about how the burger doesn't look like the advertisement. So did they make him a fresh burger?
That's a good question.
And there's another scene where it also feels like an editing choice. Like there was a scene there. There was another interaction there that just got cut out when he's walking down the street and the construction worker stops him because they're working on the sidewalk. And he says, you can't come this way.
Yeah, the bazooka on the construction equipment.
No, it's before that. It's even before that.
Oh, okay.
And that's what I mean. It's this really weird short interaction.
Oh, the other earlier
one. Yeah, the dude gets in his face. And he does it really aggressively, and defense just shrugs and moves on. And I'm like, why is this scene even in here then?
Oh, yeah. Now I remember.
You could have just cut the whole thing out, because I'm waiting for there to actually be an interaction. And instead he goes, oh, okay, and changes direction. I'm like, that's weird. That's not what he would be doing.
Maybe it's meant to build on when he goes to the other construction site later. That's why he's completely fed up with it.
Well, and the gridlock in the beginning of the film was from road construction.
Right.
Yeah.
It's this oppressive, constant road construction.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of interesting editing choices that I actually kind of liked, where the editing would just jump away before a scene closes, and then we would hear about the resolution of the scene later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or bits where it would just like linger on these looks, these pauses.
I like some of that a lot. You're right. I don't need to see the full ending. But the Whammy Burger, I'm like, well, did they make him a new burger? Because I kind of want to know. Are they even capable of giving you a burger that looks like the advertisement? Is it even possible?
But I guess, like, tone-wise, I actually did like the lightness of that scene, like, especially the manager, Rick.
Well, and there's bits of humor throughout, like when he picks up the knife. How do they even do that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the woman who just randomly spits out her food, I mean, that is... It's hard not to laugh at that, I admit. Yeah. But.
Well, apparently we got a critic.
And by the way, the blonde at the counter, that was Dee Dee Pfeiffer, Michelle Pfeiffer's sister.
Yeah, I read that too. I actually noticed her face. I'm like, she's cute. She's a cutie.
I like how continuing to play up that scene even when she was off to the side.
Well, the minute she passed it off to her manager, she was willing to play with him.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Once it wasn't her problem, she was like, you can call me Miss Folsom.
Yeah.
And she's smiling. She's like looking at the boss like, how are you going to deal with this? This is your problem now. And I kind of am on his side. I think it's stupid that I have to tell people I can't give them breakfast when it's sitting right behind me.
No, and that's why I kind of like that scene, because it plays into the wish fulfillment. This is what we wish we could do just to get that damn breakfast meal. But even then, he still doesn't get the breakfast meal.
No. Well, he changes his mind.
He's he changed his mind, though. Yeah.
But again, he's not committing to it. He's wishy-washy. He's flip-flopping, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then they're piling the food on the manager to make him give it to him.
Yeah.
I love how he's standing there with his hands up and they just shove them into his hands.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I know the original script for this, which is even earlier than the draft I read, is that it was a much more darker and violent movie. And like, yeah, he guns down the manager, you know, or he guns down all these other people. And there was a lot more civilian casualty. There was a lot more collateral damage. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of glad they didn't go that because it still makes it a much more complicated scenario.
Right, right.
And again, like 1 year after this was Natural Born Killers too.
Well, and it turns into the remake of Death Wish with Bruce Willis that missed the point, like turned it into just a revenge fantasy without realizing the whole point is the ethical problem.
That's where I think this is an interesting companion piece to the original Death Wish, the very first one, where it's taking that concept, that fantasy, but also exploring how it doesn't really work out the way you want it to.
Well, and the neo-Nazi is like, what kind of vigilante are you? And he's like, I'm not. Yeah. I just want to get home. The way the neo-Nazi is projecting onto him. Mm-hmm. Well, you're doing this to stick it to the man. No, I'm doing this because I'm frustrated and I don't have impulse control anymore. And I'm just trying to walk home to my wife and kid.
Angie, what did you think of that neo-Nazi sequence in general?
That's really something. For you to say that the alt-right is latched onto this, it's like, dude, that's your sign right there. This movie is not endorsing you.
Yeah.
Man, he is so intense. Ooh, Frederick Forrest, I think, is the actor. He did really great with that. And I do think it gives this film more depth that, no, he doesn't agree with this guy. Yeah, we saw him say some racist things in the beginning, but there are degrees. It makes him an even more interesting character, I think, that he's got all of these very strict rules of how he thinks everything should be.
Yeah, he's the privileged white male of, you came to my country, learn to speak the language, that sort of casual racism.
Mm-hmm.
But, whoa, are we talking about gay bashing and killing Jews as a good thing? No.
Yeah.
What? No.
Yeah.
I actually like that they added a moment where the gay couple does stand up to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, isn't Joel gay?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Very.
Well, and this, the AIDS crisis was still going on, so there's a lot of reasons to add that scene, and I'm glad they did, because you don't just want to see homosexuals as victims, and they would have been if they just tottered off.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's definitely something that if a straight man had directed the movie, you probably wouldn't have seen as much of that, and I think it's nice that he was able to put that in.
My only issue is, the only other scene that doesn't quite work for me is the neo-Nazi one, because it's like, I like the components. I like what it's saying. I think it just goes on too long.
Yeah.
And it does become almost cartoonish, especially when he's like, hey, look at this gas canister. Hey, look at this gas, you know, and it goes on a little too far.
Well, and it does that thing where he's talking about, I'm going to turn you in, you're going to go to jail, and you're going to get raped in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And he's standing behind him.
Right.
That it does that thing where it implies that the homophobe is himself a closeted homosexual.
Yeah.
Which, it's a cliche for a reason, though.
Yeah.
Like, honest to God, every single time you see a man who is vigorously anti-homosexuals, you're like, I'm waiting for the day when we find out you're gay.
Right.
And this entire sequence is literally happening in his closet with his stash.
Oh, Noel, I love your perspective.
I think it's a little bigger than a closet, but okay.
No, you're not wrong.
Where he pulls out his rocket launcher.
I'm sure Joel did it intentionally and staged that way. I know it's intentional. And I know that that was the subtext they were going for. And this is a 20-year-old film, so it wouldn't have been cliche territory at that time. And I don't even feel like it's truly a cliche now as much as just a trope.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do agree that it goes on a little long. And he does become so goofy in his enthusiasm. But then again, the reverse side is, I kind of like seeing a neo-Nazi in the light of weirdly just some fucked up fanboy.
Yeah.
There's a fanish squee factor.
Yeah.
He's talking about this stuff the way friends of mine talk about their collectible figurines.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What I like about him is that he will absolutely revel in the pot shots that he gets to take at people, the insults and all that stuff. But even though he kind of worships this guy for actually going out and taking a stand, it's like, he's never going to go out and do that. He's actually very much a coward.
Mm-hmm.
He'll put a rocket launcher in the hands of this guy in the hopes that it'll create more bloodshed. He's like an internet troll. He's just trying to poke the hornet's nest.
Right.
Yeah.
In hopefully a direction that will further his own amusement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And again, it's fascinating that internet trolls didn't exist back then, and yet he's hitting so many of the same buttons as to what we're seeing now.
Sure.
There are two things in this film that I noticed. One is that there's this constant thing of minorities who are not giving proper respect to their white elders, the way that is played is frustrating. You get the Korean shop owner with defense, but you also get the Hispanic cop and the black female cop who won't listen when Prendergast is trying to explain what's really going on. And they're shutting him up and they're discounting him because he's old and he's a coward. He's a desk jockey. I really like that through line. It's hard to watch.
But again, that's playing on that whole, why don't you respect me?
Yeah. And because they are not so much the shop owner, but the two cops, they are being played as you are idiots for not listening to this older white man who has figured it out. Except that in the structure of the movie, it's doing something very specific there. So it makes it an uncomfortable moment, but it's an uncomfortable moment for a purpose.
Well, and to be fair, none of the other cops are listening to him or respecting him. You know, even when he brings it up to the chief or what, you know, like they're all completely discounting him.
I mean, hell, Sandra's partner.
Okay. Yeah. The captain is being played by the same man who plays the sheriff in The Ref. Every time he opens his mouth, all I hear is, I fucked your wife, Bob, at the Christmas party 2 times.
What I love is the point, too, is one of the reasons why nobody believes Prendergast is because he has so little to go on. It's a white guy in a shirt and tie who has a gym bag.
Right.
The police captain is like, I'm a white guy in a shirt and a tie who has a gym bag. Am I on your list of suspects?
Yeah.
They play it up as something that's easy to dismiss.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And even then, he's really just kind of running on his gut for the longest time until he really remembers the car and then starts digging into who this person is. And then, yep.
Yeah. And then the other thing is the dude in the park that he ultimately gives his briefcase to, which that's a really great moment where he's got two bags and he decides to give up the one that represents who he used to be.
Yeah. And all it has is his lunch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. BT Dubs, that briefcase was a nice briefcase and you could get some money for that, bud. Don't just throw that away. But that character, I hate that character. Well, give me something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You've got two bags. That's not fair.
Who even leaves? Who even walks away and then comes back yeah. repeatedly? Again, entitlement.
You've got two. I don't have any. That's not fair. Give me one of yours.
Yeah.
What?
Right.
Are you 3 years old on the playground? That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works. And so I find that interchange. It grabs my attention because I become frustrated at it. And then I have to stop and think, what is it about this that is frustrating? And in a movie like this, every scene has an intent. So what's the intent of putting this here in this moment?
Entitlement. He's also just dishonesty.
Mm-hmm.
Everything he says is a lie.
Yeah. So the entitlement of you're supposed to have to work for it. Because these are all reflections of defense. Like you're supposed to have to work for it and you're expecting to get a handout. No, that's not how it's supposed to work.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of ramps up because by the end, when he gets to the plastic surgeon's house, he's like, okay, this guy did work for it, but it's not work that seems real.
Yeah.
And yet he did better than me. I don't even understand what the rules are anymore. Then at the very end, I helped protect America. I did everything they told me to. Why am I the bad guy?
For a war that never happened and then went away.
It's literally the lament of the white male. I did everything you told me to. Why am I the bad guy?
Yeah.
Which is also the lament of the common man in America right now, period. The common person, I should be more clear. Like, you told me to go to college. Mm-hmm. You told me that I should be loyal to my job. You told me I should do these things and that would make my life better. Why is nothing working anymore?
And when he gets to the pool home and finds out it's the home of a plastic surgeon, he's like, plastic surgery paid for all this?
Yeah. Something fake, something not real, making things look like what they're not. That's what we celebrate. I've been working as a defense contractor, keeping us safe for decades. And this is what I should have been doing.
Which bring up the pool scene.
Hmm.
Joel threw out the original scene that happened there, rightfully so, because originally he came across the actual plastic surgeon and his family who were having a poolside barbecue.
And at gunpoint, he's forcing the wife to strip in front of her family while complimenting the doctor for all the work that he's done on her.
Oh, God.
While going on a big rant about how are her boobs paying for all of this. Joel hated that scene, and rightfully so, because that is where you're taking the character too far.
Yeah.
And I like that it's just kind of a middle-class family who doesn't own this house, but the owner just lets them use the pool from time to time.
Well, does he, though? He says...
Or maybe he doesn't. Yeah.
He says, please don't tell my boss.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so he's crashing his boss's house.
He knows that they're gone, because he takes care of the grounds, so when they're gone, he and his family just come and enjoy the pool.
But I love that moment where Defense looks down and sees the blood on the girl's hand and thinks he hurt her and freaks out and panics, not realizing it's his own blood again.
Right.
There's these moments where, like in the Korean shop, where the guy's just like, take the money. And he's like, what, do you think I'm a thief? Or there where the guy's like, just take me, let my family go. And he's like, I don't want to hurt your family. That all culminates in that moment at the end where he goes, wait, I'm the bad guy? When did that happen?
Well, yeah, because even when he's in the Whammy Burger and he pulls out the gun and people start to run, he's like, no, sit down. I'm not going to hurt any of you.
And then he fires it off.
Why are you pulling out a gun then, dude? I mean,
I'm not going to hurt any of you. I'm just going to threaten the manager over here with a gun. It's completely different.
Yeah.
Well, and look at who he kills. He kills the neo-Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the only person he kills. And then he shoots the cop at the end.
But he does kind of graze her.
No, he shoots somebody else, doesn't he? I feel like there are two.
Well, he shoots the gangster in the leg.
Well, yeah. He shoots the gangster in the leg, but he doesn't kill the gangster. Right. And I know, again, in the script, when he blew up the construction site, he actually did kill people there, too.
Well, I mean, you would think there would have to be some severe injuries when you blow something up like that.
Collateral damage. And mm-hmm. I mean, there are people who die around him in the drive-by shooting.
Right.
But even when he kills a neo-Nazi, that starts as self-defense. He stabs him to get away. The stabbing probably wouldn't have been fatal.
No, I mean, but he does choose to basically execute him when he's on the ground.
And it's an execution. He stands over him and just double tap.
Right.
Is that the last sequence before he gets to his house?
Nope. Then you have the bazooka.
Oh, he's basically killing the guy on the golf course.
Then you have the golf course.
That's it.
Because the guy's having a heart attack. I mean, he didn't do it intentionally, but the guy's having a heart attack and the cart's going. No,
he doesn't shoot
him.
He shoots the golf cart.
Shoots the golf cart. The golf cart's going into the lake and his pills are in the golf cart. So he's probably going to die.
I feel like he stood up over him and actually then just popped him one.
No, mm-hmm. no. What he did was he goes, hey, how can I help you? I need my pills. Where are your pills? They're in the cart. He looks back, sees the cart go into the lake. He says, well, you're shit out of luck.
Yeah.
I don't think he would feel a need to shoot him then.
Yeah. I mean, the dude's already dying.
Plus, also what I love about the golf course sequence is we mentioned the scene with the gang members in the park. Mm-hmm. They're a perfect mirror. It's like, hey, why are you cutting through my territory?
Yeah.
And he's literally, again, he's just like, I'm just passing through. Just let me pass through.
Those thugs in the park, those gang members, and those entitled white men in their ugly pants.
And that wonderful pink poof on his hat.
Yes. They're the same people. Malcolm Gladwell has a podcast I absolutely love. He had an episode that was about golf courses, specifically golf courses in urban areas, specifically in Los Angeles, where there is a dearth of public green space. And the huge inequality that they represent of a green space that is walled off from public use and only the wealthy can use it. And we're not going to let anybody else in. And we, in fact, do all sorts of tax breaks and other things to make it easier for them to buy up this amount of land.
Catering to the wealthy.
Yeah. And so cutting across that golf course, I'm like, I have thoughts about that thanks to Malcolm Gladwell. It's called Revisionist History. It's a really good podcast.
Mm.
He even has the lines, you know, children should be playing here. Look at this.
Yes.
And it's just two old white men in the midst of this vast green.
Mm-hmm.
So that they can hit a ball. It's called a driving range.
And he keeps saying, this is my golf course. And it's not even his. He's just leasing it for the day.
Yeah. I pay my dues here. It's mine.
But I even love the contrast of the gang members are like, can't you read the sign that says private property? And he's like, oh, you should have written in English then. And then he gets to the golf course and there's a sign that says, do not enter private property. Mm-hmm. And he just hops over.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful mirroring of those two scenes.
So I was curious about where in Michael Douglas's filmography this fell. And you know what? Michael Douglas has just been consistent for decades. It's kind of freaky.
And that's because he started as a producer, so he knew how to choose his own material really well.
Well, and he would choose material and then be like, I think I'm going to star in it. It worked out really well for him.
Even on the DVDs, he talked about how this came after a period where he had just done Basic Instinct, Fatal Attraction, and a few others. And he was becoming frustrated because a lot of the characters he was playing were reactive characters. And he wanted to play a character who's inciting the incidents.
Mm-hmm.
And he almost just produced the script but didn't star in it, but Joel had to talk him into it.
Ah, I'm glad he did. It's a great performance.
Mm-hmm.
And what's also interesting is he had had that long flowing hair for quite some time. This was the first time he'd really cut his hair short in that severe crew cut look.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, he had done Fatal Attraction, Wall Street, Black Rain, War of the Roses, Shining Through.
Basic Instinct
was the one he did right before this.
Okay.
Well, he's got great hair.
He said that he was having a hard time figuring out the full character until they gave him the buzz cut and he looked himself in the mirror. And I love how they gave it this perfect square shape.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There's no roundness to it.
Well, and it's interesting because it's a military haircut.
Right. I guess that's why I was thinking, too, he was a vet, but yeah.
Again, he's the son of a soldier.
I think he's a kid who grew up with that haircut.
Right.
I think he's a kid who grew up in the shadow of military.
Yeah.
I don't think he served, but he became a contractor. Mm-hmm. His father grew up with a lot of that stuff. His father probably had a lot of issues with the Purple Heart and the injuries he brought home.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and given the timidity of his mom, his father probably had anger issues and may have taken them out on the wife and him.
And that probably also instilled the whole ideals of entitlement and how things should be.
I come home, this is what should be happening. Yeah. It's just an interesting movie. I think it still has so much to say.
Mm-hmm.
And then what was also interesting is just this odd use of children throughout. Like, not only the daughters, but you have him, like, constantly seeing, like, here's this kid in the car in front of me just looking at him. Or this kid on the other end of the park just looking at him. You know, or even the kid in the bazooka scene.
The kid in the bazooka scene, yes. I feel like throughout he keeps seeing his daughter, projecting his daughter as he's looking around. Because he's dissociating from reality a little bit. He talks to the boy in the whammy burger. He holds the hand of the little girl at the pool. The kid with the bazooka. He is trying to make connections to children around him.
Mm-hmm.
I think to prove, see, I can be a good father.
Yeah.
Or I think it's, I have nothing left. And I think that was the message that Pendergrass was trying to teach him is, you made her. She's still there.
Right.
But even then, that whole consequence.
Yeah, but through the bars of a cell?
Yeah. That whole consequence.
That's a very valid point he brings up. I went too far and I murdered someone. Like, I am going to miss her entire childhood. That's just going to happen. What's the point?
Yeah.
If you kill me now, suicide by cop, she at least gets the insurance. I can provide her a good life. I can give her the life that I was supposed to give her.
So I want to back up just a little bit where he's at the pool and he's talking about how he just wants to get home and lay with the two of them in the dark. To me, at least, that sounds like a potential murder-suicide situation.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if it was meant to be or cast doubt to that or...
Yeah, according to the commentary, it was.
Okay.
Well, and Prendergast at the end is like, I've seen guys like you. I know how this ends.
Right.
You were going to kill the two of them and then kill yourself. No, I'm not. Yeah, you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's where it's raising the, as he gets closer to home, raising the question of, well, how is this ultimately going to end? What is this ultimately building towards?
What is he wanting? When he gets there, what is he going to be asking for? Mm-hmm. He's going to arrive and be like, this is what I want to have happen. And he's painted himself so far down this corridor that he's limited his options to, I'm going to get there and kill them and kill myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know that partially because when she realizes where he is and hangs up, he takes off at a dead run to get her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a predatory move.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I feel like even when he's watching that home video that's showing him the reality that he was ignoring, even if he kind of recognizes it, he still ultimately rejects it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And still keeps continuing down this path.
Right.
I feel like there is a moment there when he's watching that video where he could have been like, what if I walk away now? But instead, I honestly feel like he gets distracted, like, okay, it wasn't great. It wasn't always great. Maybe it was me. Maybe it was at least a little bit me. Oh, wait, I know where they are.
Right.
Because the only reason he's sitting there is he doesn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I do know what to do. I know where they are.
Yeah.
And then it's like the OS takes over and takes away his executive function of, we had programmed that we were going to do this thing. And while we were on a blue screen of death, you had some free time to stop and think about maybe you wanted to do something else, but we're up and running again.
And that's what I love is he's literally sitting in his family home that he's just driven his family out of. He's literally faced with the reason why he lost all this.
Well, but the dog still loves him.
And yet he still pursues this course of action.
And the dog still loves him.
Yeah.
Dogs still love everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the contrast he's watching with the dog the moment where he gives her the puppy.
Right.
I went back and watched the trailer, and the phrase at the end of the trailer that, you know, the voiceover guy, an everyday man who refused to take it one more day. So yeah, that's the movie they were pitching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not what this movie's about.
Well,
it is, but...
To be fair, that does bring up Network, which also had this whole, well, what are you ultimately achieving through this?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, Network, though, is, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. Great, we're going to use that to sell you.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, so he still didn't ultimately achieve what he set out to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh, that would be an interesting double feature. Yeah.
If we want to also talk about interesting double features, one of the interesting things is that in the early 90s, Joel Schumacher had actually befriended and mentored David Fincher.
Okay.
And after the disaster that was Alien 3, it was Schumacher who really pushed Fincher to take on Seven. And what's fascinating is not only does this movie play out as almost a proto-Fincher movie, very much touching on a lot of the same types of stories that Fincher would explore, but it's so many parallels between this movie and Seven.
Yeah.
You know, the cop who's just about to retire. Mm.
The guy who's doing all of this to people because he's frustrated by society.
The suicide by cop ending.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of interesting parallels, especially the cop characters.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So I think this would be an interesting double feature with here. Joel did this and it obviously left an impression. And that's why Joel was actually hired on House of Cards. Maybe never speak its name until we get there again because of his friendship with David Fincher.
Okay.
Yeah. House of Cards.
We're going to have to get there at some point.
It's fine. There's a lot to love about House of Cards. It's just one of the realities of life in America right now is what choices do you make about product that includes people that are a problem now?
We'll get there.
So anyway.
I'm just trying to think of anything else major to bring up about Falling Down.
The only thing that I would say is that I do feel like the film doesn't quite stick the landing in terms of like, yes, you absolutely are the bad guy. I just feel like some of the responses that Pendergrass has toward him do not really drive the point home that this is not who you should want to be. This is not the hero of this story. Of course, you know, the whole thing we've already talked about with him and his wife doesn't help that either.
Right.
I feel like you just need a little bit more of, because even the whole thing with the toy gun, it's like he's getting his way. He's dying a martyr instead of rotting in jail for the rest of his life. I feel like it just should have done a little bit more to drive back that we've been watching a villain this whole time and not a hero.
Yeah, you're right. He dies still not having to take responsibility for his actions.
Yeah.
And yet that's fitting.
Well, So it makes him a tragic hero, and he shouldn't be.
Right.
It just makes him tragic, I think. But I don't know if it makes him a hero.
There's a heroicness to that ending because he's getting what he wants and what he thinks is best that's going to, he think, help his family. And the movie does not clearly lay out that that's not what should be happening. And I mean, it could be that it's 1993, like we knew what right was, but we still didn't know how to say it.
Yeah.
Really, we could tell that wasn't good.
Well, and again, that's an interesting comparison to Seven, where again, that's exactly how Seven ends too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The killer gets exactly what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been obsessed watching Letterkenny, and there's an episode where the Hicks are trying to talk about homosexuals and people of color. And they're doing it a lot like the good guy redneck meme in that they're not using the right words, but they're expressing the right concepts. That's what this feels like to me is this is 1993 reaching towards what they know is right, but still failing because they're still trapped in 1993. I feel like Joel knew, but he didn't know how to make it clear cut because there was still so much misogyny and other problems that it still seeped in.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's me making excuses. I don't know.
Again, you know, there have been talks in the last 10 years of doing a remake of this. If you got the right writer and the right director to do a reflection of the modern day, still carrying a lot of these themes, I think you could make a deeply compelling movie out of it. But again, it would probably be just as controversial and provocative.
Absolutely.
And
I would want it to still ride that line of comedy because you can't hit people over the head with this. It just turns them off. You need to sucker them in with, I relate to this guy. I relate to, oh, that's the problem. I relate to this guy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what I ultimately appreciate about it is that it's pushing buttons, but again, in a very smart way where it's trying to make you think about the consequences beyond the fantasy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's showing you the fantasy of, yes, don't you just wish you could do this? And then it's like, yeah, but this is kind of where you ultimately go down if you do this.
Right.
That's where I think like Death Wish and The Punisher and other stories like that work best when you're questioning, was this the right way to go?
Mm-hmm.
Or, this went too far, or there's so much collateral damage happening.
Yeah.
You're trying to right one wrong and you're making 12 other wrongs happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It made me think of Kill Bill when she goes after Vivica Fox. It's like, yeah, that was absolutely right for her. But in the process, she wounded a child.
Right.
Yeah. Honestly, what I think would be an interesting comparison is when we get to Phone Booth, because I think Phone Booth hits a lot of similar buttons.
Mm.
And in fact, the sniper in that is a very similar type of character.
Mm. I've never seen Phone Booth. I've kept missing it. I forget about it and then I don't make time. So I got to get on that.
I think that was definitely him capturing a lot of the same type of feel and themes. Because it's not really a hero-villain story. It's just a kind of fucked up people responding in very fucked up ways.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts before I jump into the box office release of the movie?
Nope,
I'm good.
So the film came out on February 26th of 1993. That was when Groundhog's Day had been the big number one release the few weeks prior. And other films of that era were Homeward Bound, The Incredible Journey. Imagine seeing that double feature. Scent of a Woman, Army of Darkness, A Few Good Men, and Home Alone 2 Lost in New York was still in the top 10 despite having been out for 15 weeks.
Wow.
Falling Down actually opened at number one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, Joel Schumacher, Michael Douglas. Yeah. And you said it was February?
It's February, yeah.
Yeah, it was in that doldrums of we need something fresh.
So in its second week of release, Falling Down was still number one, above Groundhog's Day. This was also the release of Mad Dog and Glory,
okay.
Amos and Andrew, and Best of the Best Part 2.
Holy crap, there was nothing going on cinematically that month.
No. I should mention El Mariachi is floating around there in the teens.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. But El Mariachi never made it to the big chains.
No.
It was popular in the indie chains, so it did still sell well. So in its third week of release, Falling Down dropped down to number three because Fire in the Sky came out.
Oh, God.
Okay.
Remember that was briefly a big movie?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was terrible.
And then some movie called CB4, which I'm not familiar with.
Oh, I don't know if it's a rap movie or something.
Okay.
I remember seeing the poster.
In its fourth week, Falling Down is still at number four. At number two is the Bridget Fonda remake of La Femme Nikita, Point of No Return. And at number one is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3.
Oh, oh no.
I liked Point of No Return if for no other reason than it pointed people back at La Femme Nikita.
Yeah.
People went, oh, this is a remake? I should watch that.
At least we got the TV series. The TV series was fun.
Yeah.
In its fifth week, Falling Down, it dropped to number seven, but it's still hanging in there with some legs. Ninja Turtles 3 is still number one, and Born Yesterday was number two.
Them kids love their turtles.
Born yeah. Yesterday. Oh my God, with Don Johnson and Melanie Griffith?
Yep.
Oh my God, that was a movie I'd forgotten about. Ugh.
In its sixth week of release, Falling Down suddenly plummeted to number 15.
Huh.
Ninja Turtles dropped down to number four because this is the week that Cop and a Half opened.
Oh, okay.
At number one.
Oh, 90s, you so cray.
And at number two, the Stephen Sommers Adventures of Huck Finn.
I don't even remember that.
That was the Elijah Wood one. That was a good movie.
Okay.
I never saw it.
No Jonathan Taylor Thomas in that one, or was he?
That was Tom Sawyer.
Okay. Getting them mixed up.
Yeah. But I'm surprised that that was beat by Cop and a Half.
Yeah. Well, I'm assuming the half is probably a kid.
Yeah, that was Burt Reynolds and a kid.
Okay.
Well, I'm not surprised.
I saw that in a theater with my dad and the reel broke and we decided to just leave.
Wow.
They kept making those movies because they kept making money. So of course it came out at one.
In its seventh week, Falling Down doesn't even appear in the top 20 anymore, so we'll drop here. But this is when The Sandlot opened at number two.
Oh, okay.
You're killing me, Smalls.
And at number one, Indecent Proposal.
Oh, my God.
Interesting, like, jumping back and forth between kids' films. And
yeah.
Oh, God.
Wow. In its 20th week, The Crying Game is still at number seven. So that had legs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
people talked about that movie for a long time.
Yeah, that was one that was a constant slow burn because you keep hearing people talk about it until finally you're like, I guess I got to go see this, but nobody's telling me why.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Falling Down, it only made $40 million on its initial release, which was more than its budget, but I know it was deeply controversial. It did actually get pulled from a lot of theaters. LA Times did a multiple article series just condemning every aspect of the movie.
Wow.
I know it was picketed by the Korean Grocers Association.
Rightly so.
It was picketed by the Union of Defense Contractors.
Oh, because it turned them into postal workers.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was just so much outrage about this movie. And to Joel's credit, that's what he wanted. So
yeah, I mean, it's a movie designed to push buttons. There's no doubt about that.
But also, all those people were missing the point.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like Dogma, where all the religious people hated it sight unseen. And it's like, well, if you actually saw it, it's actually a pretty good exploration of faith.
It's a really good movie about religion. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very predictable that this is a film that a lot of people were talking about, but it disappeared quickly and then became a cult thing on video.
Makes sense.
But I think because it was almost buried in film discussion, like it's only in recent years that it's actually really been very widely reappraised and discussed. I think that almost is what allowed fringe groups to latch onto it.
Yeah.
Because again, people kind of avoided it for a while, and then the Batman movies happened, so no one really talked about any of Joel's other movies for a long time.
Yeah.
It's only in recent years that there's started to become a bit of a reappraisal of some of his other filmography, and this is one of them. But even then, it's already been latched onto by these groups who, again, identify with the character without really identifying with how it explores that character.
Yeah.
In very troubling ways.
Very troubling ways. Yeah. Huh.
So, this leads us to Lenny Kravitz.
So much in common, these two things.
Joel did do a music video around this time, too. It wasn't tied into this movie. That would have been interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and it shows up in his IMDb credit, which is weird to me because those sorts of things don't normally get highlighted at the same level as a feature film.
Yeah.
But it's like Falling Down, this video featuring Lenny Kravitz. I'm like, okay.
There's been a big push to get a lot of music videos pushed on IMDb in the last few years. I mean, granted, we just came across a Joel Schumacher sitcom that was so obscure, I literally had to create an IMDb page for it.
God bless you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By the way, Wendy, that was Now We're Cooking, a sitcom pilot written by Joel Schumacher about ex-cons who work at a diner.
Okay. I actually do support the idea of, I don't know if I'd put it alongside a feature film, but yeah, considering how many of these directors got work because of videos, mm-hmm. Well, what videos did they direct that were so apparently mind-blowing that it got them a feature film?
Mm-hmm.
Please do educate me, because frequently those videos never had any credits like that.
Right.
And what's interesting is Joel kind of gets associated with that group of directors, even though he didn't direct music videos until
he had already been making films for several years.
Mm, yeah.
Even then, he's kind of always been sporadic, like just every few years he'll do something. But even then, he became a very mentor figure to, again, like David Fincher. There's a lot of that music video generation that came up inspired, again, mostly because of Lost Boys and its visual style and everything.
Yeah, it's a bunch of music videos. Yeah.
Featuring a saxophone.
It was his examination of that music video culture that influenced the style of that movie, which then influenced subsequently a generation of music video directors. So Joel directed a music video for Lenny Kravitz for the song Heaven Help. Joel doesn't really do very narrative music videos, usually just a lot of imagery, a lot of stuff going on. This is very much in the same style of his Devil Inside video, even though there is this little bit of a story to
it. Did we watch the same video? That was a story. It didn't make sense, but it was a story.
That's where I'm getting. I'm leading there.
Okay. Devil Inside had no stories. Devil Inside was people in a club.
Exactly.
This is a relationship, sort of.
But visually, it is very much that flashing imagery style. But this one does have a bit of a story where, you know, he fantasizes about the woman in the apartment across the street who's being abused by the boyfriend and dreams of going over there to stop it and saving her. But then when he actually wakes up, he's never able to make it there.
Was that what was supposed to be happening? Okay. Like, it was not clear that it was a dream sequence or a fantasy to me.
Yeah.
So that's why it was just very confusing.
Oh, there's literally a moment where after he saves her, he wakes up and then runs out to save her, but she's driving away.
But he's sitting in the bed for most of the thing for the performance, so I didn't really get that. Sorry.
Yeah, like, he's just there with the guitar. Also, doesn't somebody hand her money after sex at one point? Is she being abused or is she a prostitute?
It's hard to tell.
I'm not saying it's a clear narrative.
It's hard to tell if she's a prostitute or it almost looks like she's being abducted at the end, honestly.
Yeah. So, Angie, what did you think of the video?
I mean, I think I'm telling you now.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, I don't really like the song.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. I think Lenny Kravitz is possibly one of the most beautiful humans put on this planet in the last 20 years. I remember thinking that it was the same visual style as Falling Down. There's a certain urban look to it.
Mm-hmm.
Joel Schumacher did that urban look really, really well. What I like about even The Lost Boys is there's a desert quality. He does a really good job with that deserty, decrepit, faded glory sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the vibe that comes through, and it's a vibe I really like when he does it. Like walking down the street and the fronts of the buildings and the apartment and everything. I'm like, yeah, I groove on this. I like the visual look of it.
Mm.
It's not a terrible video. It's just there's a lot happening and it's trying to tell a story. And as we're discussing, it's not a very clear story.
Right.
To be fair, many video stories are either incredibly didactic or I think I know what's going on, but it's a little unclear.
Yeah. I guess if there had been something, and maybe it's because it was kind of a poor quality video that's available for us to watch. Yeah,
that was the best one I could find.
Like if there had been some kind of filter or something that would have made it clear, this is pretend, this is real. Like, what's the whole thing with, like, he's getting a tattoo and she's looking at him through the other side of the curtain? Like, nothing made sense. It was just kind of like, I mean, I get that he likes this girl, and then, like, it ends with her being kidnapped. So I'm like, okay, is the next video going to be him saving her? I feel like we need more of this here.
I also love that Lenny Kravitz playing a piano in a ballroom in front of a mirror, because it reminded me of that video that you and I debated if Joel had directed, where you said, no, him doing a mirror shot of a saxophonist would be too cheesy for Joel.
This was not that bad. That video was a lot worse.
That was a good video.
No, it wasn't.
This video makes more sense than Lost in the Shadows, which was dynamically directed, but what the hell was going on?
But once again, was just a performance for the most part. It was a very weird set.
It was a weird set and a weird situation that their performance was happening.
Yes.
In.
I mean, I agree, but...
And why was a kid there?
Like I said, this was trying to tell a story and just really failed to tell the story.
Yeah.
Then again, you had Lenny Kravitz. All you had to do was point the camera at him.
And he did a lot.
Yeah.
To be fair.
Just more of that. If you need a girl, let her walk behind him. There you go. Oh, look, there's a girl back there. I'm just going to look at Lenny.
Do you remember that one song, The Bittersweet Mystery of Life, where it's just the guy walking down the street?
Oh, Bittersweet Symphony.
Bittersweet Symphony of Life. Imagine Joel Schumacher doing a version of that with Lenny Kravitz, where Lenny Kravitz is wearing that gigantic scarf that he had in that meme photo.
On board.
And it's like, as he's passing people, he's just like absorbing them into the scarf.
Like the Absorbolop from Doctor Who.
Which is this weird thing of like, he's just sucking people right into the scarf.
And then it's like the second half of the video, we go into the scarf and it's this great rave.
This is a great concept for a video. That's a Texas Size 10-4, yes.
While they're not really bad, he's never really made a great music video yet.
Mm-hmm.
These are all just, here's disparate shots. There's something going on, but he's not really that clear about it. Very nicely shot and everything, but
yeah.
He's actually a very skilled narrative director. I mean, like, if you had made a music video out of the 3-minute tracking shot in the opening of Falling Down, that could have been a great music video. You know, again, like the wedding dance sequence in Cousins, you could have made a compelling music video of that scene. What's interesting about his music videos is he never really comes up with a, here's the scene that we're capturing. It's just kind of a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like when he does music videos, he falls back on being a designer and he's thinking in terms of static pictures instead of thinking narratively. I don't think he thinks you can do a whole lot with a story in 3 minutes. So he's like, here's images.
So I'm incredibly compelled to see what he does with musical numbers in Phantom of the Opera.
We'll talk about it when we get there.
That's all I really had to say. Anything else about the video?
No.
I mean, one other thing to mention is there's actually two videos for this because the record label didn't like this one, so it only played in Europe.
Maybe they were like, gee, it doesn't make sense.
And so they completely redid the music video.
Do a new one.
So that's where I was like having a hard time like figuring out what Joel directed, but he did this version, which aired in Europe. And that's why there's subtitles on it.
Okay.
Which were a little distracting.
Yeah, right?
I know. There were only two versions of this video I could find. It was either subtitles or have it stretched out to widescreen. I went with the subtitles.
I have to say, so we watch most of the musical movies that we watch on my podcast with the subtitles on for various reasons. Mm. And boy, sometimes it really points out the ridiculous lyrics that are going on.
Oh, yeah. Some songs are weird.
Oh, I'm sure.
Ooh, really? That's how you decided to rhyme that. Okay.
One other last thought that I have, just stepping away from the music video, one little thought I just kind of want to leave off on is... This makes me want to see the Batman movie Joel wanted to make, where he wanted to make a lean, gritty crime drama. I think he would have been capable of doing that.
Yeah. The tone might have been a little odd at times, but I think overall he probably, he could have done it.
Oh, I think he absolutely could, except that nobody thought that that's what superhero movies were.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The first Batman had been so successful, but that was Tim Burton's vision, which isn't gritty, it's gothic, which is different.
Right.
There were still these weird trappings of gothic that came along with it, and because studios didn't think that these movies should be serious... or like actually have any true emotional weight or dramatic weight, that Joel didn't know what to do with it. I think he could make a decent Batman film now.
I still think if you had given him the script to Batman Begins, the only real difference you would have between what was made and what he would do is that his would be linear.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying he would make Dark Knight, but I think he could have pulled off Batman Begins.
Rather than giving him a New York story, I'd want to give him an LA story. He does so well with that environment. He shoots it well. He gets that dry, dusty heat.
Well, he does great with New York,
too. He was born in New York City, right?
Yeah, but I like the visual style of Lost Boys and of this.
I think he's just good with urban environments. I think he could do any major city.
I would love to see like a falling down Punisher sort of superhero movie. Like, give me the falling down streets and put like a Punisher type superhero in there, directed by Joel Schumacher, and I'd be there. But don't give him too much money, because then he makes poor choices. That's my theory right now. When it goes big budget, things go haywire.
I think that wraps up our episode on Falling Down.
Yay!
Yes.
Thank you for joining us, Wendy.
Yes, thank you.
This has been great. It was lovely talking to you, and it was great to revisit this film. I'm glad I did.
And it was great recording something with you in only 2 hours.
Those were epic sessions.
And we're done. Good night, everybody.
Good night. For additional episodes or to leave a comment, please visit schumacast.blogspot.com.
That's schumacast.blogspot.com.
Schumacast can also be found on Stitcher.
Our opening song, Letter, and our closing song, Vane Blossom, were created by Jack Locke and are used with permission.
To hear more, please visit jacklocke.com. That's JAKLOCKE.com.
Schumacast is in no way affiliated with Joel Schumacher or the copyright holders of the films discussed.
All rights are reserved, and no infringement is intended.